Hey everybody, welcome to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. I'm your host, Brenton Bickerstaff, and this week on the show we have an interview with Henry Reed. Henry has been the prime designer of the ARE's Psychic Development Program in its various aspects for the past 20-some years. He developed the ARE's program of evaluating psychics. He has also published scientific articles on his research in intuition and psychic functioning, and is a regular contributor to the ARE member magazine Venture Inward. He's the author of Edgar Cayce on Awakening Your Psychic Powers, Edgar Cayce on Channeling Your Higher Self, and Your Intuitive Heart. He is also on staff at Atlantic University and is a regular mentor for ARE online learning e-groups, including the upcoming e-group entitled The Spiritual Applications of Self-Hypnosis. You can also discover the world of the intuitive heart at edgarcayce.org/intuitiveheart. Here's my interview with Henry Reed. All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the show today, Henry.
Yeah, well, I'm really glad to be here. I'm grateful for this opportunity.
Excellent. I'm very happy to have you on today. And I'd like to start with just a first question of what first introduced you to the ARE and the Edgar Cayce material?
Well, I think that I'm really glad you asked that because there's a story behind that I think that's very important. I remember Hugh Lynn Cayce saying that there were lots and lots of people out there who were influenced by the readings, and that their work in society was being affected as well, and we would never know about it. He was trying to be encouraging about that, you know.
Right.
Well, it was my beginning is in 1968, and I've written about this. This story is in the very first issue of Venture Inward magazine. I also published it in a Jungian journal called Voices, this story. And I had I was a graduate student at UCLA in psychology, and a good old friend of mine, James Spurrell, he was the president of our senior class at Pomona College. He was very well respected, looked up to as a Renaissance man, and he and I had spent some time together. We ran a pipe shop together. We sold special tobacco pipes out of our room, he introduced me to a lot of little gourmet things, like a special brewed coffee before that was even an item. Now, we graduated 1965. I didn't know it at the time, but he didn't go to graduate school, except he was immediately brought in to teach at a graduate school in art. Many years later, he was one of those, what do they call them, McDougall Genius Award grants. And he's working, he's very well known, he's a Quaker, he's even done art. He does work with light, natural light, and he has a huge 150-acre ranch in Arizona that surrounds a volcanic crater that he's turning into a meditation site on the sky.
Oh, wow.
And this is a major Rodin crater. This is a major piece of art that's going on, and he introduced me to Cayce back in 1967, and he was into it because of his dreams. Now, this is really what the story is. I run into him, we say, well, what are you up to, you know, and he takes me over to his studio. I was living in Dennis, California, and he had a studio in Santa Monica, California, near the beach, a big place. He had no means of support that I knew. I said, how in the world did you get this studio? And he said it came to him in a dream. And in his dream, his father, who had passed, took him around Los Angeles and passed this building and said, here's where you could have a studio for free. And so when he woke up from that dream, he went and found that area and found it was an old abandoned hotel or grocery store, I'm not sure what it was, some kind of a business with big windows, storefront windows. Mm-hmm. All painted over. And the owner of it agreed that he could have it rent-free in exchange for doing carpentry on the inside to make it habitable. Then I was really impressed by that, and we could talk on and on about adventures we had in his studio because he set it up as a giant camera obscura, kind of like what they had down there on the Santa Monica Pier. I was a graduate student at UCLA there. I graduated in 1970 with a PhD with honors and started teaching at Princeton University. But now in 1967-68, during my studies, I run into this James Sorrell again. I hadn't seen him for a while again, and I said, where had you been? And he said he'd been up on his motorcycle to San Francisco to help out a friend because he had a dream that they were in trouble. And I asked him, I said, James, where have you learned to dream like this? We didn't learn about dreams like this in graduate school. Well, all we're learning is dreams are like stool samples you take to your doctor for an examination. You're using dreams for guidance. Where in the world did you learn how to do that? And he said, Edgar Cayce. And I said, who's that? And I forget exactly what he said, but he said to me, here, let me help you get a dream journal together and you can start. I never remembered any dreams at all. And he helped me make a dream journal. And he came over and he gave me one of his pictures and put it in my dream journal. And I started on a New Year's Eve. It was New Year's Eve, I guess it would have been 1967, December 31st, and I wrote in my journal that I was going to start my new life because I was going to have dreams for guidance like James had. And I woke up with the next morning and I had no dream. And it wasn't until April sometime, April 6th or 7th, that I finally remembered a dream, and it was almost by accident because I had reached... I got up without a dream, and it's when I went into my closet to find a shirt that all of a sudden I remembered something about a flying goat. And I thought, I lived in San Diego and grew up there, and I thought, well, maybe that was about the zoo. And I couldn't remember going to the zoo recently, and I sat down on my bed, and a dream came to me, and I won't go into it now. Like I said, there's links to it, you know, on our new Edgar Cayce Intuitive Heart website. They can read that whole story. And that started me recording dreams. It started me on a spiritual, I was an alcoholic, and I was in denial. And the dream started bringing me into a place where I had a healing in my dreams from the active alcoholism. I started into analysis. And at the same time, I went to my first lecture at Princeton. At the end of my lecture, a boy comes up to me and says, boy, the way you talk, you ought to know about Edgar Cayce. And this kid from at Princeton was from Virginia Beach, and his dad was a minister, and they were into ARA and stuff.
Right.
And he said, you know, Virginia Beach is just down Route 19 there. It's only an eight-hour drive. Then I went to a conference at the Managers Foundation, the Council Grove Conference, where at the time where Rolling Thunder spoke for the first time. And I met a fellow there, and I was talking about, I was already in hot water at Princeton because at Princeton, at the psychology department, they used a lot of deception in their experiments. And of course, then they paid students to be in the experiments because they were like guinea pigs. But I was doing the opposite. I was taking a humanistic approach, and I was now, because of my own work learning how to remember my dreams, I wanted to involve the students in learning how to remember dreams as an academic project.
Right.
And I charged the students to be in my experiment, and that outraged the department. But I said, at least in my experiments, the student learns something from being in it, and I'm not deceiving them, and they get to participate in the creation of knowledge.
Right.
I was talking about this to some fellow I met at Menninger's clinic out there in Kansas, and he says to me, you know, that's funny because my granddad used to think that way. And I said, well, who was your granddad? And he said, Edgar Cayce. And it turned out I was talking to Charles Thomas Cayce.
Oh, wow.
So those are the three things that introduced me, and he invited me to come to Virginia Beach and start a research program because research was their middle name, and
right.
They never really had a handle on how to do it. And because of my, I guess, my, you might call it grassroots approach or whatever, I said, well, let's do membership research where they can grow from their participation and help us create knowledge. First, we had a project on meditation done by Herbert Puryear, and then I did the dream research project. And we could talk about that, too, sometime, because that also goes into the origin of this intuitive heart work, because you see, all of this stuff grows organically from dreams. This whole program on developing, what would it be like to have a community of souls who communicated with each other through the imagination, which is the language of souls. this all was kind of like in the background through these years of development. When I first then set foot in Virginia Beach, I stayed at Charles Thomas's farm, and I had a dream there. We ultimately called the dream of the research dance, and we used that as a kind of an ideal behind these home study research projects. Out of the, and what we did, and that was, it made news. I mean, it was a history-making event in the realm of dreams. Because what I did was I showed through a workbook that I created for the people to use that contrary, see, I was brought up, say, the traditional schooling in psychology is don't encourage people to handle their own poop. Let only the professionals handle their poop because they'll get into trouble. And I'm talking about dreams as if they were poop.
Right, absolutely.
And I wanted to rescue dreams from that perspective.
We'll be right back with more from Henry Reed here on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. Welcome back to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We'll get right back into my interview with Henry Reed.
In the Edgar Cayce perspective, dreams aren't poop, they're diamonds from heaven. And so what I did was I created a workbook that included a step-by-step. This was based on, way back then, they called it program learning, program text, where you'd write out a text where you give instructions step-by-step for a discovery process, because the students were going to learn not by reading a book, but by following a recipe and going and doing experiments. So what we did was, what I included was an adventure that you're going to go on a dream quest. And Cayce had a very important hypothesis that's often even not even really mentioned in airy circles anymore, perhaps, and that is your own dreams will teach you how to interpret them if you make a commitment to apply and put into practice what you think they're saying. And they're very forgiving as long as you're sincere about trying to figure out what it is that they're saying and that you put into practice what you think, what you sincerely think they are saying, and then they'll correct you. So I had what we would call an iterative approach where you do a little something, you get a little feedback, you change your approach, you try something different, you get a little feedback, and we did a four-week experiment. And what it demonstrated through the reports they sent in, this astounding fact, contrary to the poop hypothesis about dreams, and that is this: your average person can, in fact, make use of their dreams if they're trying to apply them for something constructive in their lives. And the key to what makes it okay or safe or whatever for the average person is the application, is the trying it out. In other words, if you'll be a scientist about your dreams, that doesn't mean being a left brain, get out the yardstick, but a scientist tests their ideas in action. And that's what the dreams want of us, because what they're trying to do is it's our soul reaching out for empathy, and we get the empathy by the behaviors that we engage in that create the experiences that allow us to empathize with our soul's perspective, and the dream story is trying to guide us into that. If that's the, without going into a long thing about what we're kind of deciding about in the evolutionary purpose of dreams. And if it required people to go to a psychoanalyst in order to fulfill the evolutionary purpose of dreams, we'd be extinct. And it looks like we might be headed toward extinction, but I've been trying to give the dreams back to the people. That's how I got my name, the father of the dream work movement, because I was rescuing dreams from psychotherapy and returning dreams back to the people, using some very different kinds of methods that allow the ordinary person to make use of dreams. And that's where this dream helper ceremony comes into play, because I think this is a very significant thing. And this isn't about me. This is about a process that came about through the dream inspiration of many people. My own dream of the research dance organized how the experiment works, but it was children at ARE camp who showed that it was possible and motivated us to create a ceremony. And I just structured it. It now, this the Dream Helper ceremony, which is the backbone, the solid backbone of this whole intuitive heart world of the intuitive heart discovery, is where a group of people dream to help somebody who's in distress, who asks for help, but doesn't say what their problem is, and the group of people promise to dream for them. And research has shown out of Columbia University that it enhances dream recall. Almost everybody remembers a dream that next morning, regardless of how many years it's been since they had remembered one. They pretty much universally feel in the morning that their dream probably was a failure because it seems ordinary, and if they were on their own, they probably wouldn't have recorded it. Since they had promised to remember a dream and bring it back the next day, they recorded it and brought it in. But you know, just I say this because the dreams are not special. They do not seem special. Now, what makes it possible, though, it's a group of people. And so when they start telling their dreams in the circle, and the person being dreamed for is sitting facing away from the circle like a fly on the wall, and they have no idea how this person is responding to their dreams. But as they start discussing them, they start finding there's a lot of commonalities in their dreams. And it's the group being able to explore commonalities that makes it possible for them to derive the help that's in the dreams. And they don't really have to know any dream psychology to do it. It's just awareness of life. I could give you a real quick example, you know, to concretize it for you. You have one dream where a person is driving their car and they come to the light turns red, so they stop. They wait for the light to go green. It goes green. They start to enter the intersection when they notice out of the corner of their eye that somebody's running a red light, so they have to hit the brake and wait for that guy to pass. And then they get back hit the accelerator and continue on their way. That's the first dream. And the second dream, person's watching TV when a commercial comes on. So they get up and they go to the kitchen to get themselves some coffee. And they pour themselves a cup of coffee out of Mr. Coffee. They go in the refrigerator, get some half and half, and they start to pour the half and half into the coffee. And they notice that the half and half is soured. And so they toss that out, and they go back into the refrigerator, and there's a fresh carton there, and they pour some fresh cream into their coffee, and they go back in the living room, and the commercials are over, and their show resumes. Now, there's two dreams. We could try interpreting them, and they're very different. They don't have a single word in common. And most people can recognize there's something very significant that they both have, both dreams have, and that is, two people are kind of ho-humming their way through something that they do all the time when fortunately they notice things aren't the way they usually are, and they stop just in time to avert something, you know, that would be otherwise unfortunate. And you can start then doing some what we call on TV now FBI profiling as to what might be going on here. And as a result of that kind of discussion, when they're all done, they've pretty much nailed what the person's problem is, why they're having so much problem with it, and maybe what they could do about it. And then when they're all done with that, they ask that person to turn around, and that person is just like ready to pop a big balloon. They just can't believe what they've been listening to.
Oh, wow.
And that process, the Dream Helper Ceremony, has been done countless of times. You don't need a leader to do it. You just have to bring it together. It's been the study of 3 doctoral dissertations. It's one of ARE's best-kept secrets.
Yeah.
I would say that if somehow we had the resources to let the world know about this, it's so expressive of the Edgar Cayce philosophy. Because one of the things that happens is, you know, a dream, as Edgar Cayce said, is always about you. And so what I give the people then, let's look at the dream for yourself. Now they can see in the dream for them that the dream is saying something about themselves. And what is it saying about themselves but their own version of this issue? And all of a sudden, the person who'd asked for help has now become the teacher, because that person has shown that everybody is capable of getting guidance on that issue. And everybody, we're all in the same boat, in a sense, you know, and it's helping people come together for a larger sense of empathy. starts to build the feeling of, I may be an individual as my dream is unique to me, but I am one with the whole because we were all working on this same theme without even knowing that we were doing that. An individual and one with the whole, if you get my meaning there, gives the feeling to the people of being an individual and one with the whole. And this is something that is so replicable and easy to do. That's what I said. It's the ARE's best kept secret. I had told Charles Thomas years ago, if they had put the money into letting the world know about this, it would bring people to the Casey material. But it was so associated with me, like as if somehow I was trying to make me famous. I'm not trying to make me famous. I'm just trying, you know, to maybe put a little food on the table. I am trying to get this thing out there. That's why we're training people to go and spread it. That's why we're doing this thing. We hope to be able to find some ways to encourage ARE membership to try it on their own, you know, and reflecting stories. I want to make a movie. Make a movie for TV that starts out at ARE camp, you know, and you can see the kids around the... I had brought in this dream tent, you know, based on my first dream, and the kids would sleep in the dream tent, and other kids would have dreams about that kid in the tent. And I think that's just such a great beginning of a movie because that's how the dream ceremony got started. And then you'd have a scene of somebody at home calling up on a telephone and saying, Mary just got a hold of me. She's having a big problem, so we're going to dream for her tomorrow night. Meet at Shoney's. And we see that in the movie, you know. And at the end of the movie, people at home are saying, gosh, that's such an obvious thing to do. We could do that. Honey, let's go get with our club, you know, because it's so-and-so. Maybe we can do something here. Spreading this out. I mean, Casey was a natural, indigenous American shaman. And that means that he was capable of bringing the wonderful gifts of the superconscious mind for the use of his people. And this kind of thing is very American. There's nothing weird about it. And yet, it does help people to bring in the diamonds from heaven to help one another. And the reason it works is because it has the purpose of being of service. It's not about, oh, look, I'm being a psychic or something like that. I think, you know, he started out, his innovation was, be your own psychic. But his real legacy is, we can be psychic together to improve the planet. And that's what the intuitive heart discovery is about, showing that we can be intuitive together. And the Dream Helper Ceremony was the first of that. Then I asked the question, see, well, how do they do that? How do the people go to sleep at night and then dream for somebody, and there's no instructions have ever been given about how you do it. That's the interesting thing. When I was giving a keynote address at this Association for the Study of Dreams, it occurred to me on stage that, hey, no one has ever asked me how you did it, and how are we supposed to do it, you know?
We'll be right back with more from Henry Reed here on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. Welcome back to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. We'll get right back into my interview with Henry Reed.
Now we say, if you remember your dream, the job is taken care of. It'll work. Just remember your dream. That's all you have to do. Just remember your dream. Based on some of my own intuitive experiences, I started developing some experiments that became the basis of the Edgar Casey Legacy Conference, Be Your Own Psychic. These were experiments that... I had developed and wrote peer-reviewed articles. Again, this is another best-kept secret at ARE, using the conferences and using the field conferences as my laboratory and getting feedback from the people. I was able to write a very comprehensive article about one method. I had a big fight about it because I was suggesting face-to-face telepathy, which is unheard of. You always think of telepathy over a distance. Psychologists might call it unconscious communication. I was using the sound of a person's voice, and I was having one person just make a voice sample like 99, 98, 97, 96, and so on, while other people would just sort of vibrate internally to the sound of the voice. Now, I knew from a lot of background that this is a setup for unconscious communication. But what I was trying to show... That's what Edgar Casey was talking about. They when he was asked about how come the experiments don't work, he said, well, because you erase the reason for any telepathy in the first place. And that's the relationship dynamics between the people or communication or something going on. That telepathy is not a matter of brainwave synchronization, it's a matter of intimacy. And I was showing through this experience with just the sound of the voice as whether or not people are willing to be intimate with one another will have a lot more to say with whether or not they will, quote, telepathically pick up things about. And it's sort of really the case of it takes one to know one kind of a thing. I was bringing out some very important aspects of what goes on in our unconscious telepathic communication with one another and how this relates, again, to the evolutionary dynamic, you might say, that Edgar Cayce talks about, that all of our experiences are given to us to awaken us to the fact that yet we're an individual and yet one with the full co-creative power. So every experience that we're having is an invitation to awaken. And I see that there's a lot of unconscious communication going on to see if what we can learn from one another vicariously, and maybe some experiences we don't have to have because the other people have had them and we can kind of live through them. And why is it that sometimes at conferences people seem drawn together? Well, it's not an accident. They're talking unconsciously to each other. And the intuitive heart discovery process shows how this is going on. The trouble is, like when we were doing this, this is contrasted, and it's hard for people to understand because they're coming really from a 19th century perspective that's given in the standard kind of parapsychology terms of ESP and telepathy, relaxing, tuning into the other person, and so on, as if they're operating, you know, somehow in a three-dimensional space, and now they're teaching people how to use special ESP parts of their brain as like radio machines or something. Whereas the intuitive heart discovery approach, more like Cayce, is that we're operating in a fourth dimension of meaning of thoughts. We're not working in a three-dimensional world. So this whole thing about surrounding yourself with light when you open yourself up to higher spaces, those are all three-dimensional metaphors. And that's fine, you know, because if you want to live in the 19th century about all this stuff, but that's what it makes it all scary, too, for people, and why they have to put tinfoil around their heads, you know, when they feel that they're being bombarded by telepathic thoughts. Take it through the intuitive heart discovery process. We're working through kind of like a heart, not in a Valentine sense, but you might call it a feeling intuitive approach that approaches things not in a materialistic three-dimensional way, but more in a sense of meaning. I'll give you a really good example of that. In one of the discovery processes that we use that came out, I wrote a two-part publication about this in the top Jungian journal that comes out of London. They called it a minor classic. It's been referred to many times, written about in books. And what I was doing there was showing about the dynamics and the topography, you might say, of what it's like for people to feel like they are in mental contact with another person. And what does that mean? And what I did, and this was just, it was just stuff that was going on at the Airy Be Your Own Psychic Conference, and at the field conferences on it, I'd have people pair up, and then I'd lead them through a special meditation. We call it the Inspired Heart Meditation. And then I would have them imagine that they were having a heart connection with the other person. Now, this is something that people do all the time, but I was doing it very systematically. I want you to imagine having this heart connection with the other person and notice what you experience. That was basically the instructions. And they would get 3 minutes of silence to just experience that. Then they would talk amongst themselves about what happened. Now, that's a very simple kind of a thing. So how could I write 100 pages about what was going on and what we could learn from it? Well, we learned some very important stuff. It's right in the readings, and it brings readings out into a modern sense because it gives us kind of like a handle on a periscope, an underwater periscope. You know, like Edgar Cayce and Carl Jung had a lot of things in common, but they came from different places. Jung had a lot of experiences, but he was an academic and an intellectual and a scholar. Casey had his own experiences, but he wasn't a scholar. But then he stepped out and took a real risk with this whole reading business. And he got his education directly through the unconscious.
Right.
But it's really interesting how they came away with some very similar ideas about the evolutionary dynamic that's going on, about individuality and oneness, a lot of stuff. Very, very, very similar. I'm very grateful to be able to have both of those, you know, as part of my heritage. Anyway, what Jung said was that we all look like islands to one another in the ocean. But if we would only stick our heads under the water, we would see that we're all connected. Casey gave it the idea of a star, that the mind is like a star with points coming down, and each of us are the points on the star. But if we would dip into the subconscious mind, we would experience that we're all connected. We can communicate with each other. So one had a look-down approach, the other one had a look-up kind of a thing. But they're both saying that through the subconscious mind, there is a connection. That word connection, of course, is a three-dimensional word. I like to use the word that there is the possibility of communication, empathy, and of shared mind. And so we found out, for example, that after the end of the 3 minutes, what did people experience? And we found that people experienced two kinds of things. They had two kinds of vocabularies. In one vocabulary, they were aware that they were sitting in one chair and their partner was sitting in a chair in front of them a few inches away, and light was going between them, energies and so on and whatnot. And in the other kind of vocabulary, it would be like they forgot that they were sitting in a chair. Instead, they were somewhere else, off in a daydream. Me and my partner, we were shopping in a store. Me and my partner, we were flying together, dancing. I was sitting in my partner's house, something like that. And you look at the difference between the two conversations. One is set in the three-dimensional world, and the other one is in the fourth-dimensional world. It's in the world of daydream. It's not in the here and now, the two chairs with the space in between and them being individuals. On the other one, the daydream, their energies are merged, and this daydream is coming about. And this is where the intuitive heart comes into play. This is the periscope that allows you to see underwater and the communication that's going on. And we found out, of course, that people have different feelings about one another, and they don't always want to communicate with each other. And some people really get it off well, and other people don't have a lot to say to each other at the unconscious level. When you go into a horoscopes for everybody, astrology charts, you find out that people that have no planets in common in terms of where they are don't have a lot of energy things to say to each other, but people that have a lot of those things in common have a whole lot more. So, you see, we're getting way beyond some kind of ESP training. This is really the 21st century kind of work that I'm seeing based on my research, Dance, where I'm seeing that the world is heading toward a oneness. And it's going there kicking and screaming. There's a way of doing it gracefully as well. And these exercises are meant to help us who have that kind of an ideal to learn to develop this other way of seeing so that we can hear the communications and participate in this larger conversation that's going on in the unconscious. So we don't have to rely on the various channelers to come forth. It sounds, you know, it's kind of repetitious, but we're capable of doing this. As I had mentioned to you, as part of the purpose for this blog is that DayArea has been supporting me now in these special programs that I do to introduce people to these realities that you need to experience for yourself. And we have this Big House program coming up this September.
We'll be right back with more from Henry Reed here on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. Welcome back to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We'll get right back into my interview with Henry Reed.
And I hope they'll go to the website, theedgarcayce.org/intuitiveheart, to see about this opportunity starting on September 15th to come up where it all began at the Big House Lodge at the near ARE camp at Mountain Valley Farm. White Rock Creek Farm is what it's called right now, where we're going to spend a week together exploring these exercises, eating fantastic meals together, and meditating and being out in the country in the fall in this beautiful climate, where each of these exercises or these rituals of discovery or however you want to think about them can be shared among the same group of people, and they start discovering how they're interacting in a very supportive way to help one another with this whole evolutionary dynamic of coming to know ourselves, even as we are known, that we are lights in one another and lights in creation. And it has a lot to do with self-acceptance and forgiveness. And when people can somehow come up with stuff that shows that they empathize with you more deeply than you could ever imagine. In fact, it takes imagination to empathize so deeply. And in these rituals, what happens is people are asked to use various subconscious means of accessing the subconscious to, in some sense, sing a song about you. It's obviously coming from them, and I'm speaking poetically here. But it touches you deeply because it shows, without them even knowing that they're doing this, such deep empathy. And then when we look at our songs in the mirror and we realize that we have found the other person within our own hearts. And what's making it so touching is that what we're learning about them is something also that's important about us. And there's a sharing there where we have things that maybe we've never told another person. And now here's somebody else who feels exactly the same way, but we never would have thought in any kind of gathering to bring this up. Why would they have brought this up? Except it was the thing we most needed to share in order to let something go. And there's been a healing and there's acceptance and so on. That's why one of the reasons long ago, I started a book about this, and I called it The Fig Leaf Factor, because I could sense the lifting of the veil in which the things that keep us in the illusion of separateness was going to be lifted. At first, I thought it would be lifted fast, and now I see this being pulled off slow, like a Band-Aid. But some people are already showing the effects of the amount of subconscious communication going on among the planet, juicing one another up or bringing peace, depending upon where your ideals or whether you're into fear or love, as this one planet is becoming so interconnected that the unconscious communication or telepathy is going stronger and stronger as the outer world is losing all the boundaries that we might normally steer by to keep a sense of separateness, and it's beginning very hard to distinguish that. But those people who can ride those subconscious waves and look at them and understand them because they can be aware of them, and then they can see what's happening and understand it and ride these waves more gracefully. And the thing about the fig leaf factor, if you look back at the Garden of Eden, what was the sense of judgment that came in with the sense of separateness? And we have a special ritual that we go through with the breath that lets each of us relive that moment in the Garden of Eden where we could perhaps bite through the apple and experience our nakedness and welcome the sun and the wind upon our nakedness and bless it all and thank God for telling the snake to get us to eat that apple, because now we exist but we haven't lost our sense of oneness. And this is what the intuitive heart discovery brings about when it's brought about in a group of people. And I cannot share this experience except in that way, because this is not about people developing their intuition to get ahead in the world like most of all of the other intuition training practices or programs are about. This isn't even about developing your intuition, because you're already have enough of it. It's already functioning. This is about learning that you can share your intuition with others, and we can be together intuitively, and a joint discovery starts coming about that enables us to live in this other new subtle world that's coming about. If you will draw upon your intuitive abilities, you can learn and grow through joy. And it's especially easy to do that when you're with others. Casey really recommended that. And so I have developed the intuitive heart discovery group process, which allows a group of people with no teacher. I have the manual. They get together over a period of 6 meetings, and they come together to have these experiences and share and come together over a period of time. The book is available, you know, to do that. But I've never meant to be exclusive. One of the things about the Intuitive Heart Discovery Program, you see, in the new world, there are no secrets, so trade secrets. So everything like this program we also give away, it's all on the website, edgarcasey.org/intuitiveheart. You can get access to everything if you follow the links closely enough, the recordings, the scripts, it's all there.
Well, that's all the time we have for the show this week. I want to thank my guest Henry Reed for sharing his wisdom of the Intuitive Heart and Dream Helper Ceremony with us. I encourage everyone to visit the website at www.edgarcasey.org/intuitiveheart. On this website, you can learn more and put into practice the incredibly helpful resources brought to light through Henry's dedication to being of service. If you'd like to see Henry in person, he'll be a featured presenter at the ARE conference, Awakening Your Psychic Potential, The User's Guide to Developing Your Psychic Ability, here in Virginia Beach, from November 8th to the 10th. To register for this and other conferences at the ARE in Virginia Beach, visit edgarcasey.org, click on Events, and then click on Conferences. Don't forget to check out the Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey Facebook page. I'd love to hear your feedback on the show. And I'll end the show with a thought for the day from the Edgar Casey readings. Today's thought for the day is from reading 3660-1, and it reads, "In the consciousness of eternity, time is not, neither is space. In man's consciousness, there appears so much mercy, so much love, that these have been called time and space." I'll read it one more time because this one to me is very powerful. In the consciousness of eternity, time is not, neither is space. In man's consciousness, there appears so much mercy, so much love, that these have been called time and space. I want to thank everyone so much for tuning in this week. I'm your host, Brenton Bickerstaff, and I hope everyone has a beautiful week.